We are going to be talking about Joseph. So we've been talking about Jacob for a long time. Last time was a transition. And maybe if the children want to come forward, we'll have a little children's class to start off. So okay. Joseph, and Joseph was the favorite son. So, what do you think it means to be a favorite?
I know.
Yes, Elise.
It means to be famous.
To be famous. Well, he wasn't. We all know about Joseph. Anybody who was at vacation Bible school learned about Joseph, right? Who was Joseph? Joseph was Casey, right? That was fun. Yes. What were you going
to
say, Grayson? Yeah. Looking for Bible school, a little advertisement.
Yes, I don't know what it is.
Well, we'll find out this summer, maybe. Yes, Grayson, you were going to say something.
Favorite means like if that's favorite of one of us, like dad could have a favorite of his children. He might like Sophie the best.
That's right. He might like Sophie the best. He probably would be your mom, right? That's right. That's because she's his only wife. So anyway, so I thought, let's see. I have something in my pocket here. Oh, this is a problem with pockets. These are too deep. Okay. So I thought what we would do is we would say, Tanya, you get a penny. And Elise, you get a penny too. Okay. And Victoria, you get a penny. I hope I have enough pennies. I'll give you a quarter, Grayson. Quarters are worth more than pennies, aren't they?
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, let's see if I have another penny. Oh, there's a penny. Let's see. Hopefully I have one more penny. I counted them, and I should have seven in my pocket, which you all are only six, so lots of quarters there. Wheel. Ah, there it is. Ha! That was scary for a second. Okay, I have two pennies, so I'm going to give you the shiny one, okay? So I gave Grayson something that's worth 25 cents. I gave the rest of you all 1 cent. So who do you think my favorite is?
Me.
That's right, Elise. By my actions, you can tell that I like Grayson the best. Grayson was my favorite. I looked at Grayson. I said, he needs a quarter, and all the rest of you just get pennies. Oh, no. That's terrible, isn't it? Who would have ever thought that somebody preaching would have favoritism? Well, just because I'm this kind of a person, I am going to give the rest of you all a quarter, too, because I don't really have favorites. So here's a quarter. So now you have 26 cents. And here's a quarter, and you have 26 cents. You do, too. I can find the rest of the thing. This is a problem. I need shorter pockets, I think. So I'm going to give you a penny, Grayson, because you already have a quarter. And here's a quarter. Wow. Don't spend it all at once, okay? And there you go, too. So does God have favorites? Grayson.
No.
No, he doesn't. That's right. So Jacob did, and Jacob's parents did, but God does not. So in Acts 10:34, Peter opened his mouth. Truth, I perceive that God shows no partiality or favoritism. So whenever you thought that I was going to give Grayson the most money, that didn't feel very good, did it? And you probably knew I wasn't going to really show favoritism to it. But in our story today, Jacob had a favorite son. And who was that favorite son? It was Joseph, that's right. So when I was a boy, we used to do things like we would go to the zoo days. So we would pick the hottest days and we would go to the zoo. Uh-oh. Okay. And so then my mom would get one. This was back when I only had two siblings. And she would get one big drink and we would share the drink. It didn't seem quite right.
What's about Missouri before.
This was not in Missouri. This was somewhere else. Yeah, we didn't wait till you were born. So, my brother and my sister always took two long drinks, and I didn't get enough, and I barely survived. Listen.
They just always leave me behind when they are going to Puerto Rico.
Okay, well, definitely shows some favoritism there, doesn't it? So we're going to talk a little bit more about this in the sermon, but there are a lot of verses in the Bible that tell us that God does not show favoritism. So in the early church, they whether God had favorites and whether he favored the Jewish people more than the Gentile people. And the Apostle Peter came to the conclusion, no, God doesn't. God cares for everybody who loves him. Isn't it? Mm-hmm. You all can go back to your parents and try not to drop your coins. So I wonder if you all ever thought of a sibling of yours was more favored of your parents than what you were. And often children feel that way. Even if they don't feel that way all the time, they have a particular brother or sister that they think, you know, that one is mom and dad's favorite. That has to do with the age. So in our family, Anna has gotten to do things before her siblings just because she's older than some of her siblings. So as they get older, they can do things. So it's really not favoritism if you let your oldest child drive and make the rest of the children wait till they're 16 to drive. So you don't just say, because you turn 16, everybody in the family gets to drive. Because Anna and Vincent can drive, but Elise cannot. And she's not going to be able to drive for a long time. So I was doing research on this, and 40% of Americans say that their parents played favorites in their family. That seemed like a high percentage to me. And the sad thing is that the child who's the favorite child often feels lonely. They feel isolated. And 30% of families who said that they had favorites in their family when they were growing up said that there is somebody in their family that they no longer speak to. They are separated from that person. They do not speak to them because of this favoritism that went on. And these patterns are destructive to families. And as we look at the stories of the patriarchs, we see a pattern of favoritism. Maybe in the case of Abraham, it's understandable. Abraham favored Isaac. God told him to. But in Isaac and Rebekah, they both had sons that they favored. Isaac favored Esau, and Rebekah favored Jacob. And when we come to the story of Jacob and Haran, Jacob had a favorite wife. Says, then Jacob also went into Rachel, and he also loved Rachel more than Leah, and he served with Laban still another 7 years. Genesis 29, verse 30. And the following passage says that when God saw that she needed, he gave her children. So Jacob should have known better. He knew how this destroyed his relationship with his brother Esau. And yet, we see as he got older, as he had children, as Rachel and Leah both had children, he favored Rachel's children more. And from a parental standpoint, I think most of us do our best not to show favoritism, but it's hard. And sometimes we do something that seems a little children. But the sad thing as we look at this passage is we're going to find out that even though Jacob's sons had grown up, they had not matured in their relationship with their younger brother. So let's go to Genesis chapter 37, and we're going to read Genesis 37. A whole lot of stuff. So we're going to try to go through this and then take some lessons from this story. Genesis 37. Now Jacob dwelt in the land where his father was a stranger, the land of Canaan. This is the history of Jacob. Joseph, being 17 years old, was feeding the flock with his brothers. The lad was with the sons of Bilhah and the sons of Zilpah, his father's wives. And Joseph report of them to his father. Now Israel loved Joseph more than all of his children because he was the son of his old age. Also, he made him a tunic of many colors. But when his brothers saw that their father loved him more than all, they hated him and could not speak peaceably to him. Now Joseph had a dream, and he told it to his brothers, and they hated him even more. So he said to them, "Please hear this dream which I have dreamed. There we were, binding sheaves in the field. The sheaf arose and also stood upright, and indeed your sheaves stood all around and bowed down to my sheaf." And his brothers said to him, "Shall you indeed reign over us, or shall you indeed have dominion over us?" So they hated him for his dreams and for his words. Then he dreamed still another dream and told it to his brothers and said, "Look, I've dreamed another dream. And this time the sun, the moon, and 11 stars bowed down to me." So father and his brothers, and his father rebuked him and said, What is this dream that you've dreamed? Shall your mother and I and your brothers indeed come to bow down to the earth before you?" And his brothers envied him, but his father kept the matter in mind. Then his brothers went to feed their father's flock in Shechem. And Israel said to Joseph, "Are not your brothers feeding the flock in Shechem? Come, I will send you to them." So he said to him, "Here I am." "Please go and see if it is well with your brothers and well with the flocks, and bring back word to me." So he sent him out of the valley of Hebron, and he went to Shechem. Now a certain man found him, and there he was wandering in the field. And the man asked him, saying, "What are you seeking?" So he said, "I am seeking my brothers. Please tell me where they are feeding their flocks." And the man said, "They have departed from here, for I heard them say, 'Let us go to Dothan.'" So Joseph went after his brothers and them in Dothan. Now when they saw him afar off, even before he came near to them, they conspired against him to kill him. Then they said to one another, "Look, this dreamer is coming. Come, therefore, let us now kill him and cast him out, and we shall say, 'Some wild beast has devoured him.' We shall see what will become of his dreams." But Reuben heard it and delivered him out of their hands and said, "Let us not kill him." And Reuben said to them, "Shed no blood, but cast which is in the wilderness, and do not lay a hand on him, that he might deliver him out of their hands and bring him back to his father." So it came to pass, when Joseph had come to his brothers, that they stripped Joseph of his tunic, the tunic that was on him. Then they took him and cast him into a pit, and the pit was empty. There was no water in it, and they sat down to eat a meal. Then they lifted their eyes and looked, and there was a company of Ishmaelites coming from Gilead, and their camels bearing balm and myrrh on their way to carry them down to Egypt. So Judah said to his brothers, "What profit is there if we kill our brother and conceal his blood? Come, let us sell him to the Ishmaelites, and let not our hand be upon him, for he is our brother." And his brothers listened. And the Midianite traders passed by. So the brothers pulled Joseph up and lifted him out of the pit and sold him to the Ishmaelites for 20 shekels of silver. And they took Joseph to Egypt. Then Reuben returned to the pit, and his brother was not in the pit, and he tore his clothes. And he returned to his brothers and said, "The lad is no more, and I, where shall I go?" So they took Joseph's tunic, killed a kid of the goats, and dipped the tunic in the blood. Then they sent the tunic, and they brought it to their father and said, "We have found this. Do you know whether it is your son's tunic or not?" And he recognized it and said, "It is my son's tunic. Wild beast has devoured him. Without doubt, Joseph is torn to pieces." Then Jacob tore his clothes, put sackcloth on his waist, and mourned for his son for many days. And all his sons and all his daughters arose, but he refused to be comforted. And he said, "For I shall go down into the grave to my son in mourning." Thus his father wept for him. Now the Midianites had sold him in Egypt to Potiphar, an officer of Pharaoh, of the guard. And we realize as we begin this chapter that we are moving on. The story up to this point has been a story of Jacob, of Esau, of Isaac. And now, the next 13 chapters are going to tell us the story of Joseph and his brothers. And Jacob recedes into the background. He interacts with the brothers, but he seems ineffective. He doesn't really have much to say about them. He was probably never a terribly good parent, and the end result is that his sons were pretty chaotic in their behaviors. So Joseph is the younger son. Of Jacob's sons, only Benjamin was. The passage specifically says that Joseph was favored because he was a son of Jacob's old age. And we know a little better than that. We know as well that Rachel was Jacob's first love and greatest love, and as a result, Jacob loved Joseph and Benjamin more. Earlier, we saw that when Jacob divided his group up, when they were fearing attack by Esau, he separated out companies. He had the children and the concubines in one group, and then Leah's children in another group, and finally Rachel's family in a third group, and they were last of all. So now we find that Jacob gave a tunic of many colors, and the Hebrew word here is ketanet pashim. And I'm no Hebrew scholar, but in researching this, it's often translated something like a royal garment. So, you know, coat of many colors, not. But the idea was this was a really expensive garment. This was something that was difficult to make. And it isn't so important that we know exactly what it looked like. So if you, at your next birthday, just like Joseph had, I bet you would be disappointed. And you would not wear it to church. Even though it was really a neat thing for Joseph to have. We'd probably drop it off at Goodwill and hope that somebody different tastes than ours would wear it. But the important thing was this coat identified Joseph as a special son, as the head of the family, and as the one who would get an extra portion of inheritance when that time came that Jacob passed. And Jacob's sons all knew this. They could see the coat, and every time they saw this tunic, it aggravated them. It bothered them because Joseph was chosen because of qualities that had nothing to do with who Joseph was. Now, we know from the rest of the story that Joseph actually was a pretty amazing person. But the brothers didn't see that. Brothers never see their siblings as being amazing, do they? Probably sisters don't see their siblings as being amazing either. They probably, you grow up with somebody, you're like, you know, it's just, you know, that's John. What do you expect? Sure, he thinks he's something special, but what's somebody like that? And Joseph was a tattletale. This aggravated his brothers even more. So we see a couple different things in here that are going to bother their brothers. So the coat is the first thing. Second thing is that he told stories about his brothers. Those stories were true. Any question that Joseph saw things that his brothers were doing that were wrong. His brothers weren't well behaved. We don't know what those stories were, but the fact that he brought them to Jacob probably wasn't the best thing. Of course, he was a teenager. Things like this, don't they? And I'm not sure what the right thing for Joseph to do. Maybe go to his brothers. Maybe that would have felt pretty dangerous to Joseph, but he was still bothered by his brother's behavior. But I do think we need to be about if we see somebody who's doing something wrong, we need to ask ourselves the question is, what are we motivated by? Do we want to see somebody just get punished and put in their place, or do we want to see them improve? And if we want to see them improve, then, you know, we should do to help them to improve. I'm not sure what motivated Joseph here, but certainly he felt like his brothers had problems and he was going to help set them right by telling his dad. It didn't seem to help much, did it? Dreams, and we'll get to those in a second, but it says that Joseph's brothers hated him. Even before he told them their dreams, they hated him. Now, earlier we said that Leah felt like she was hated by Jacob. And I don't think Jacob really hated Leah. He just loved her less than Rachel. But I think here, Joseph's brothers were hating Joseph. They were wrong. It wasn't Joseph's fault that Jacob loved him more, but they were still angry at him. So Joseph told his brothers some dreams that he had. And these dreams seem to be the same dream, don't they? And we've talked about dreams before. They're different kinds. Many times dreams seem to have been night visions in which God would share something about his will for somebody or a future event with somebody. And Joseph seems to have had dreams about the future. His brothers just perceived these as being arrogant. He was just proud. And I've shared with a couple people, but I had a dream one evening a while back that a church in Brookneal contacted me to have revival meetings there. And I was excited about preaching at this church because I knew their style of service is a little different from Mennonite style of service. But Elaine put her foot down in my dream and she said, if you can go away and preach other places, you can kneel and share the gospel there. And I said, okay. And so we went to this church. And they, for some reason, they had a carry-in before the revival meetings were going to start. And so we put our plates and sat down. And then the preacher stood up, and he said that Brother John Waldron is going to be sharing revival meetings. And everybody got up and left, except for the preacher and his family. And then I woke up. And so I asked Milo, I said, Milo, what do you think this dream means? Well, he didn't know. I guess he doesn't have the gift of interpreting dreams, or maybe he just doesn't have a cup of divination. Maybe that second thing. I'm going to go out on a limb here and say this is not a prophetic dream. So no churches in Brookneal have contacted me to preach there, and it's been several months since this dream. So, and I don't know that I would preach there anyway. So I have enough things to do. So this was a different kind of dream than my dream. And we know that by the end of the book of Genesis, don't we? But the problem with Joseph's dreams is that they all seem to involve him being one family bowing down to him. And I suppose we can understand his brothers and his father not feeling really excited about these dreams. I wonder if Joseph thought they would be. It's like, these are amazing dreams. And Jacob said, not so much. So Joseph's brothers were grazing livestock near Shechem, and Jacob decided to send Joseph to check up on them. Shechem was about 50 miles from Hebron, where Jacob was living. And Joseph got to Shechem, and we get this picture of him wandering around the fields there, looking for his brothers and not finding anybody and not sure where to go. So days, of course, they didn't have smartphones or even cell phones, and so he couldn't just call them and say, hey, where are you all at, and then go meet them. And some man came and saw him wandering around and said, what are you looking for, and told him where to go. Go to Dothan, 15 miles from here. It's a long journey for a 17-year-old to make. That's 65 miles from Hebron. And as Joseph's brothers saw him coming, they conspired to do him harm. It reminds me a little bit of the story of Cain in Genesis chapter 4. So the Lord said to Cain, why are you angry and why is your countenance fallen? If you do well, will you not be accepted? And if you do not do well, sin lies at the desire is for you, but you should rule over it. Now Cain talked with Abel, his brother, and it came to pass when they were in the field that Cain rose up against Abel, his brother, and killed him. For years and years, Joseph let hatred fester in their hearts against their brother. And as long as Jacob was close by and watching over them, nothing was going to happen. But now they were 65 miles away from home. And Joseph was on his way. They could see him coming. He was wearing that special coat, and they were angry. And they decided they're going to do something about this. They killed Joseph. And when we're children, we're told that Jesus is watching us all the time. But maybe this doesn't always feel like a big reason for us to do what's right. And we just what we know is right at the door. And we do something wrong as long as we think that nobody that is an authority over us will hear about it. And so Joseph's brothers attacked him. I think this story is very horrible. Up what it takes for a crime to be considered premeditated. So if you have first-degree murder, it has to have been what they call premeditated, which means planned out. So most of the mystery stories that you read, like Sherlock Holmes murders, those are premeditated. So they're just somebody plans out all this stuff that then Sherlock Holmes has to solve. And so this was not premeditated. They didn't plan this out long time in advance. But they did see that they hated, and they all got together and planned to hurt him. And what makes this story so bad is the way that they talk about Joseph. There's just a callous disregard for him as a human brother. And these were men who had killed before. We know that Levi and Simeon had gone through the city of Shechem and killed every single man in the city. Every single one. These were men who knew how to kill. And they call him the dreamer. Joseph didn't control his father's favoritism, and he didn't control the fact that God gave him dreams in the night. And so they're planning to throw him in a pit, and Reuben decided he would save Joseph. And he doesn't seem like he was the strongest person, but he thought, well, if I get them just to put Joseph in the pot, kill him, I can rescue him later on. And the passage does say that Reuben rescued Joseph. He did. Without Reuben there, Joseph would have been killed. And yet at the same time, I wonder how often are a little bit like Reuben, and the people around us are conspiring to do something that we know is not right, is not the best, and we stand by and we hope that we aren't going to get blamed for it down the road. And Reuben came back and found that Joseph was gone. It was too late. He cried, he wailed, he wept, but the deed was done. So the brothers took Joseph's special coat. They threw him in a pit. They gave him no water because there was no water in the pit. And then they sat down to eat a meal. And it doesn't say here, but in Genesis 42:21, the brothers were in Egypt, and we'll get to this later on, but they said, "We are guilty concerning our brother, for we saw the anguish of his soul when he pleaded with us, and we would not hear. Therefore, his distress is come upon us." The brothers are there eating their lunch, their cries coming, they harden their hearts against him. And somehow, in their heads, they rationalize the fact that they had not actively killed their brother, it was okay to let him die of thirst. And they got some kind of pleasure out of the fact that these dreams would be foiled. What would become of Joseph's dreams now? So, fortunately for Joseph, perhaps, maybe not. Maybe if Reuben had let him out, things would have been okay. There was a band of traders coming by, and they sold Joseph for 20. Over. And a number of commentaries remark on the fact that Joseph is a type of Christ here. Jesus was sold for 30 pieces of silver and redeemed us all. And in the same way, Joseph was going to redeem people who hated him, who despised him, who actively tried to kill him. And yet he had been sold for 20 pieces of silver. And finally, the brothers rationalize things. So we see this kind of weird thing where they're willing to kill their brother, they're willing to sell him into slavery, but they're not willing to lie to their father. Instead, they took a coat, his coat, put blood on it, and asked their father a question. This, do you recognize it? So much better, right? They haven't lied to their father, and yet they've done so many terrible things. And I think so often people are like this. They rationalize the bad things that they do, and they say, well, I didn't lie. Yes, but you did lots of wrong things. So where was God in this story? So I really would like to sit and think a little bit the rest of this sermon. Did God factor into this story? What did Joseph feel when he went from privilege to the pit, to Potiphar's house? Have there ever been times that you went from to the pits of despair? And I was thinking about my lowest times, and I remember like it was yesterday, a trip that my family took at Christmas one year. And I thought it was a good trip. We had seen, and we came back home, and we unloaded our vehicle, and we got back inside. It was around midnight. And my father gathered us, the older ones of my family, into the kitchen, and he told us that he was divorcing my mother and leaving. And he drove away. And I couldn't sleep that night. And I prayed like I'd never prayed before, that God would heal things that I knew were broken. And God didn't answer that prayer the way I wanted him to. And the question is, when John is in the pit, when you were in the pit, is God listening? Does he care? Does he have a plan that is worth pursuing? Psalm 34, 17 through 27, through 22. The righteous cry out, and the Lord hears and delivers them out of all their troubles. The Lord is near to the broken heart and saves such as have a contrite spirit. Many are the afflictions of the righteous, but the Lord delivers him out of them all. He guards all his bones, not one of them is broken. Evil shall slay the wicked, and those who hate the righteous shall. The Lord redeems the soul of his servants, and none of those who trust in him shall be condemned. And I believe this psalm has promises for us. God promises to hear us when we cry out. But the thing is that when we cry out to God in a time of suffering, the only thing we want to hear from him is help is on the way. Your suffering is going to go away immediately. Sometimes he doesn't do that, does he? For many years, there have been abundant life preachers who've said that God doesn't want you to suffer. God will give you a wonderful life. Just name it and claim it. And the verse on the board over here, these things I have spoken to you that in me you may have peace. In the world you have tribulation, but be of good cheer. I have overcome the world. We are going to have suffering in this world. There are trials and troubles. We will have sufferings because we are Christians, but we will have suffering just because the world is a messed up place. But Jesus promises peace. And that's different from relief of suffering. We have peace because we know that Jesus is preparing a place for us. We also have peace because he has sent the Holy Spirit, who is a comforter and will walk with us through every valley. We have joy in the midst of suffering because we serve a master who has overcome the world. Psalm 41 through 3, I waited patiently for the Lord, and he inclined to me and heard my cry. He also brought me out of a horrible pit, out of the miry clay, and set my feet upon a rock and established my steps. He's put a new song in my mouth, praise to our God. Many will see it and fear and will trust the Lord. And this came to my mind as I was studying Joseph because of the mention of the pit. Now, Joseph was not in a miry pit. His pit was dry. But it's the same concept that he is in a place. And the author of this psalm speaks of leaving the pit, to stand upon a rock. In the book of Genesis, it's only a few chapters from the time that Joseph is sold as a slave to when he's finally freed from prison. 13 long years. Think about what you were doing 13 years ago. We were in Indiana. I don't know what was going on then. From a human standpoint, we'd like to spend 10 minutes in the pit, 100 years on the rock. And yet I think the question we need to ask ourselves is if we are willing to accept God's will for our life, even when we find it challenging. 12, the story of David, and about how he was anointed to be king when he was a young man, and about how long he spent in the wilderness. And he went to Ziklag, a city in the land of the Philistines, and he went away for a long time, came back, and there had been devastation in that town. The Amalekites had come through. They had taken all of their wives and families and livestock away. And thinking. And 1 Samuel 30, verse 6 says, "And David was greatly distressed, for the people spake of stoning him. So they turned against him. It's your fault, David, that we're even here. Because the soul of all the people is grieved for his sons and for his daughters, but David encouraged himself in the Lord his God." Now, I don't know if this was David's darkest hour. I'm sure he had plenty of dark times when Saul was pursuing him. But in this moment, though he'd lost everything, the people around him were him, he consoled himself in God. Charles Spurgeon said, "I, the preacher of this hour, beg you to bear my witness that the worst days I have ever had have turned out to be my best days. And when God has seemed most cruel to me, then been most kind. If there is anything in this world for which I would bless him more than for anything else, it is for pain and affliction. I am sure that in these things the richest, tenderest love has been manifested to me. Our wagons rumble most heavily when they are bringing us the richest freight of the bullion of his grace. Love letters from heaven are often sent in black edged envelopes. The black with horror is big with mercy. Fear not the storm. It brings healing in its wings. And when Jesus is with you in the vessel, the tempest only hastens the ship to its desired haven." And I suppose there's two dangers when we look. One is calling suffering good. Suffering is not good. Pain feels bad to us, and it is there for a reason. And when we can escape it, we should escape it. At the same time, there are some people out there who almost seem to believe that we should pursue suffering as a good thing. Romans 8, 16 through 18 says, "The Spirit himself bears witness with our spirit that we are children of God. And if children, then God and joint heirs with Christ, if indeed we suffer with him, that we may also be glorified together. For I consider the sufferings of this present time are not worthy to be compared with the glory which shall be revealed in us." God, Paul, Christians will escape all suffering, nor does he say that suffering is good. He simply says that if we can persevere through the suffering in our life, that glory awaits us. And that's a good thing. On the other hand, it is dangerous when we come to the conclusion that God is not good. If we see the suffering in our life as an indication that we serve a vindictive God, that's a problem. Romans 8:28 says, "And we know that all things work together for good to those who love God, to those who are called according to his purpose." And what this means, gloriously happy all the time, but it does mean that Satan can do nothing to spoil God's plan for your life and for my life. He will try, and we will suffer. God's plan will come to pass. So how do we survive suffering? I recently read a book on hope by Lewis Smedes. And I thought it was interesting that he said that hope begins with discontent. If your life is totally heavenly and you can't imagine anything that you would change in your life, you don't hope for anything else. You are happy. Everything is perfect. It is when we wish more that we hope for something more. And he goes on to say that contentment with discontent is what we call patience. The opposite of hope is worry. Sometimes people cope with the tension between worry and hope, and they get relief by giving up hope. Romans 5:1-5, therefore, having been justified by faith, we have peace with God through our Lord Jesus Christ, through whom we also have access by faith into this grace in which we stand and rejoice in hope of the glory of God. And not only that, but we also glory in tribulations, knowing that tribulation produces perseverance, and perseverance character, and character hope does not disappoint, because the love of God has been poured out by the Holy Spirit who was given to us. We know Paul had a lot of tribulation in his life, a lot of trials, situations where people didn't say they should have, people beat him, he was shipwrecked, he says that he was waylaid by bandits. And it seems as though if his mission was right, if he was pleasing God with what he was doing, the path for him to share the gospel should have been made smooth. And it wasn't often. Paul's focus in the book of Romans was on faith. The idea being that it is through faith in Jesus that we and that the whole puzzle of our life starts to fit together and make sense. Now, I'm not very good at jigsaw puzzles. Anna is much better than I am. But I will tell you that my experience is it's a lot easier to put the puzzle together when you on the box. And if you don't know what the picture looks like, it takes a lot longer. Now, you can put it together. But once you see that picture, things start to come into place a lot more easily. And faith lets us see the picture. J.B. Phillips renders this passage, this does not mean, of course, that we have only a hope of future joys. We can be full of joy here and now, even in our trials and troubles. Taken in the right spirit, the will give us patient endurance. This, in turn, will develop a mature character, and a character of this sort produces a steady hope, a hope that will never disappoint us. Already, we have some experience of the love of God flooding through our hearts given to us. The love of God is the key, and our willingness to experience it. And somehow we need to reach the place where we can see beyond this place of wrath and tears to the great love our Heavenly Father has loved us. I recently read a book called 12 Years a Slave. It's written by a man by the name of Solomon Northup. And he was a free African living in the state of New York in the 1840s. He had a wife and three children. And at some point, a couple of men were journeying through, and they offered to pay him money as a traveling musician. He could play the fiddle a little bit, maybe a lot, and the pay would be excellent, and he was in need of money, and so he went with them. And they journeyed to New York, and then they went down to Washington, D.C. And while they were in D.C., the men drugged him, slave trader who beat him until he would not say his name anymore, gave him a new name, sold him down into the deep south, into Louisiana. And over the next 12 years, he was beaten over and over again. And he watched fellow slaves, and he described the terrible times that he had in dealing with this oppression. And yet he never lost his hope in God. And he still hoped one day that he would see his family again. He did. One day he met a Quaker man who was working as a carpenter. He gave him a letter. Quaker man was afraid. He wasn't sure if the people around found out who had sent this letter to his family back in New York, if he would get into big trouble. But Solomon's letter was delivered, and over the next couple of months, he was freed. And he came home and he saw his family again, and they didn't recognize him because it had been so long and he'd been under such a hard labor. And this is not like the story of Joseph. He never had some magical thing where he freed a bunch of people or anything like that. The only thing that he could do was write this book and say slavery is not good. And yet, he still kept hope. As he wrote of his love for God. Romans 15:13 says, "May the God of hope fill you with all joy and peace as you trust in him, so that you may overflow with hope by the power of the Holy Spirit." Not a fruit of the Spirit, and yet if we can maintain that hope, it is so much easier to experience joy and peace. Hope is the way in which we see beyond the sufferings of today to the better future of tomorrow. Else, we hope because we love and we serve a great God. He has planned great things for us, and more than that, he tells us to take heart. He has overcome the world.